time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for July 20th, 2019. We are two-thirds of the way through the Tour de France, and while there's still no clear winner, there is a lot of chatter about the media coverage. Phil Liggett is there, of course. Bob Roll, who is always fun and interesting, is there. And then there is NBCSN's perhaps misguided choice of Lance Armstrong voicing the race. I don't know how you feel about it, but if you haven't been following some of the commentary about the commentary, it's often not too flattering to Mr. Armstrong. There are also a lot of great stories this week, from the good news that Delta Airlines has decided to allow bicycles on board without the $150 fee, to a great story by Carlton Reed about Mark Rohan, a Paralympian who credits cycling with improving his life. If you are interested in the many stories that come across my desk each week, I usually share and post them to the Outspoken Cyclist Facebook page. And did you notice that both of the stories I mentioned were happy stories? Anyway, let's get on with this week's show, because it's a big one. As promised, I had a conversation with Jeff Wolfe. He's the CEO and inventor of the Morpher folding helmet. You may remember that Consumer Reports gave the Morpher helmet a thumbs down. I wanted to give Jeff a chance to defend his company and his product. I also invited the CEO of the Children's Womb Helmet, which also received a Do Not Buy rating, to offer his story, but he hadn't gotten back to me by the time this show was being put together. The offer is, of course, still there. And while we're in the UK, which is where Jeff Wolfe happens to be, we'll check in with Paul Robeson. Paul is the CEO of Bikeability and the Bikeability Trust, the organization, which is funded by the government in the UK, along with many consumer partners, is a three-part cycle training program, mostly for children, taught in school, and teaches practical skills and understanding for cycling on the roads today. Then after our mid-show break, we'll take a few moments to catch up with Peter and Tracy Flukey for our July call. Unfortunately, it will be our last for this trip, as they abandon at 1,456 miles out of the 7,000 that were planned. Still a lot of riding, and we'll find out what happened and why they're back home. Last, and certainly not least, we'll talk with Leah Flickinger. Leah was the editor-in-chief of Bicycling Magazine. She's now the editor of content creation at the Hearst Enthusiast Group, which owns not only bicycling, but also Runner's World and Popular Mechanics. We'll chat about a wide variety of topics, including the recent Bicycle Magazine survey that resulted in an article titled, "Hey, Bike Shops, Stop Treating Customers Like Garbage." So sit back or get on your trainer and get ready for another edition of the Outspoken Cyclist as we welcome Jeff Wolfe, CEO of Morpher Helmets, to the show. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thanks, Diane. Hi. Very good to be here.
Well, I felt it was really, really important that we talk with you. We just finished our conversation with Steve Frothingham, and I want to make sure that your helmet, your folding Morpher helmet, has a chance to sort of contradict or at least tell us your side of the story with the Consumer Reports giving you a do not buy. Tell us a little bit about the background of your helmet and your testing.
Okay, so the background of the helmet is I actually came up with the idea a long time ago in 2010 when we first had a kind of city bike style scheme start in London, which was called Boris Bikes. Man who may become our prime minister.
Yes, I know that. Boris Johnson, right?
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, exactly. So they were called Boris Bikes, and they're, you know, just as a slang term, but that's what sort of stuck. And they're all over London. And what I noticed immediately was, well, pretty much immediately, because I was in the West End where they are, was that literally nobody was wearing a helmet. And I reckon about 20 years before that, I'd had a really nasty bike accident, and I was wearing a helmet, luckily, and it saved my life because I ended up hitting a curbstone at really high speed with my head. So, you know, I broke my nose and I damaged some ribs, and I think I broke some ribs. And anyway, I survived that. So I think always on my mind was I wasn't particularly an advocate that used to go out there, but when I noticed no one was wearing helmets, I wondered why. I thought it might be because they're too cumbersome to carry around all day. And so I got some students and we got together. We did a survey of cyclists and, hey, presto, that's exactly what we found. People weren't wearing helmets because they didn't want to carry a bulky helmet all day on the off chance they may or may not get on a Boris bike. I thought, I wonder if we can make a folding helmet. And I spoke to some designers and to some people and everyone said, no, it's impossible. And for me, that's like a red rag to a bull.
Right, of course.
So I sort of thought, no, it's got to be possible. So I think, as I say, this was back in 2010. So I started with bits of paper and sellotape and then bits of plastic and then bits of balsa wood to try to make a model of something that could approach and possibly work. Then I put some patents in when I thought I had it sorted. And then sort of over the next couple of years, well, what I did was I did a very early crowdfunding on Indiegogo, early days, and we... I put the helmet on there with the designs that I wanted to produce. And right at the beginning, this is really important you and your listeners understand, right at the beginning, I got British Standards involved, who are the people that do all the standards in the UK, to make sure that this was a safe helmet. And I got all of the necessary criteria from them and sort of designed the helmet around the standard. And it took a long time. We did the Indiegogo campaign. I had a target of $35,000, and it seemed to take an age to get to that 35, but it was only actually a week and a half. And then we ended up with $400,000 by the time we closed the campaign. And what that told me mainly was that a lot of people, there weren't any other folding helmets at the time, that a lot of people saw the attraction of a folding helmet. And so once we had that money, I could afford to go over to China. I interviewed no less than 19 separate factories I visited. And then I finally decided on a huge factory called Strategic Sports, who make for many of the world's major brands. And they started to produce the helmet for me. And right from the start, it was the finalizing of the design was done with safety standards. Absolutely incredibly important. So that's CPSC and CE. And one thing that's interesting about Strategic is they've got the biggest testing facilities in the world where they test internally, the biggest sort of bicycle helmet testing facilities, and they do tests all the way through. And then those tests get basically helmets get sent to SGS, who are pretty much the world's biggest testing facility independent. And they tested it separately. And of course, we passed all the testing, so we knew we were safe. We passed all of the CPSC, which is US, CE, which is the rest of the world. We haven't yet tried for the Australian standards, but we're going to. They have a completely different rating system. So I was a bit surprised when we saw the result that came in. And from all of our tests, we can't replicate this. We can't find why this failure came about. And so I've got to really refute it fairly strongly because it just doesn't agree with the data that we've got. And I know that when consumer research, who incidentally, I think it's a great organization that they do, that they look at products on behalf of people. But I think when they get things wrong or when it's not correct, I don't know. It certainly disagrees with our results. So I'm sure they did their best. They used the wrong size head form at the beginning and we pointed that out. And then they say they retested it. And this is where we're at.
First, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Jeff Wolf. He is the founder and CEO of Morpher, which is the folding helmet that Consumer Reports gave a do not buy to recently because it failed one of their tests. So wait, I want you to back up a second and tell me about the head form that they used, because Steve and I just talked about how they do this. So it was the impact test that they say it failed.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they did an impact test, and we asked them for details, and they sent them to us, and they used what's called an M for mic-sized head form. And they sent us their test results, and I sent them to the factory to say, what's going on? Why did this fail? And our chief of testing at the factory, Billy, came back immediately, and he said, of course it failed. They used the wrong size head form. It's not, the helmet's not designed for heads of that size, and they should have used a J head form. So we informed Consumer Reports immediately of that, and they told us they'd retested, and it hadn't passed that either. But we've not had much more data from them, so it's very hard for us to understand why. But they do quite happily say that they're not really a certified helmet testing house.
True.
And also, their test is very definitely not the CPSC test. And the CPSC test, as far as I'm concerned, is the one that's built for helmets.
Well, it is. It is. It has been for years. How many helmets have you sold?
Well, we've made tens of thousands of helmets now, and we've sold them all over the world. Interesting, I mean, for what it's worth. And we've got, I think primarily New York is our, we've got a lot of city bike users using it. I've just been speaking with Ken Podziba, who runs the Bike New York, and he's been a Morpher user for years, and he's a big advocate for bicycle safety, more bicycle lanes, etc. He uses his Morpher daily. And also Ben Kalos, who's a New York City Council member, he actually bought a Morpher from our original Indiegogo campaign, and he still uses it daily. He uses city bikes daily, and he's another big advocate for more New York City bike lanes. So, I mean, those are sort of two fairly high-profile users we've got in New York City. But
do you think that the Consumer Reports report or comment or saying that you failed the test, how do you think it's going to impact your business, or have you already seen an impact? And is there a way to come back and say, look, you need to retest it and then re-report on it? Will they do that?
I don't know. Look, we've seen an impact, certainly. I think it's too early to really say what the impact will be in the longer term. I think that we've passed the official standards. We continue to test as we produce new batches of helmets. Everyone is tested. A sample from every batch is tested, quite a large sample. I don't really think that Consumer Reports have said what they've said. If they want to retest, they can. But I don't really want to get into some battle with them. They're a very large organization with a great reach, and I don't want to end up having some sparring match with them. I think, you know, they've given their report. It's fair enough. I think it's very, very harsh to say that our helmet is a safety risk, because according to the US government standards, it's not a safety risk. I can safely say that I don't know of a single helmet that we've had. We've not had a report of an accident with a helmet where anyone's been injured with an impact because of our helmet. And I think most importantly, what we're managing to do and trying to do is offer a helmet that folds, which gives people the convenience of being able to use a helmet where they might not otherwise have had one. And
right,
surely that's got to be a great thing. And, you know, with the advent of scooters and e-bikes, it's even more important that people wear helmets. And we've got cases of people. In fact, I should send you the link because you might like it. One of the people or the first person we know whose life was saved by Morpher, we're sure of, because he had said he would never wear a helmet because they were too bulky for him. He went out and bought a Morpher, and 2 weeks later, he had a very major bike smash, and it saved his life. There's a video of that on our on the internet, and I'll send you a link to that, Diane, if you want to let people know about it.
Sure.
So, I mean, I think that's what we're doing, really. We're allowing people who perhaps wouldn't otherwise have worn a helmet at all to actually wear a helmet.
Well, I wanted to give you the opportunity to tell listeners your side of the story. We've been speaking with Jeff Wolf. He is the CEO and founder and inventor of the Morpher folding helmet. You can see it at morpherhelmet.com if you're interested. Jeff, thank you so much for talking with me, and good luck going forward.
Thank you so much, and I love what you're doing for cyclists.
Oh, thank you.
So keep up the good work.
All
no,
right.
It's brilliant.
Take care.
Brilliant.
Okay.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Jeff Wolf joined me from the offices of Morpher Helmets in the UK. If you're interested in the folding helmet, you can log on to morpherhelmet.com. So let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll speak with Bikeability's Paul Robeson. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back. I'm Diane Jenks, and you are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. England put its money where its mouth is when they committed £12 million per year to the Bikeability program for children. More than 350,000 children per year learn how to handle a bike beginning in third grade. Let's find out more. Hello, Paul. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Diane. Thank you.
Well, I'm really pleased to be able to talk with you. One of your instructors, and we'll explain what that means a little bit later, sent me a message on Facebook and said, you really need to talk to Paul Robeson. And I'm like, okay, let's find out about what he does, who he is, and about the organization. So what is Bikeability and the Bikeability Trust?
Okay, well, I'll start with Bikeability, which is it's the cycle training program in England. It's mostly concerned with children and children at primary school. And there are three levels to Bikeability. The first level is taught when they're younger and they do it on the playground. That's all about handling their bike, mastering bike control, ultimately learning to ride while looking over their shoulder without veering off course, for example, and riding one-handed. Then they go on to level two, which is on quiet roads, and they start to learn to share the road with other road users. And then level three, which is usually in secondary school, they go on to the same thing, but on busier junctions and busier roads, roundabouts, that sort of thing. So, and it's quite a big program. About 2.5 million children have done it. We're currently training about 350,000 a year, which is not all children. I'd like it to be all children, but it's not quite all. And it's funded by the Department for Transport. And they put in about £12 million a year. And essentially, the costs get passed on. It's costs about £40 per head, per child, to deliver the training up to level two.
So I'm just wondering how long this program has been going on.
Yeah, it's been going for 12 years now. It started off small and then ramped up and got quite big. And it's been funded by different governments of different political persuasions throughout the years. It's one of those things, I think, because it's about children, cycling, safety, health, environment, and so on. It ticks so many boxes, and it's so popular with the children and their parents and the schools that it's actually a bit of a no-brainer now, really, for government to fund it. Although I have to say that we have an English phrase about touching wood. I'm obviously always grateful.
Yes, we touch wood here too. So how is that different from the Bikeability Trust?
Right. The Bikeability Trust is a small charity, and all we do is administer Bikeability. So we're sort of at the center of the web, administering the quality, dishing out the grants, making sure that people do what they say in return for the grants. But the people who actually really matter are the people who deliver Bikeability, the instructors and the organizations that they work for, who are registered Bikeability schemes or Bikeability providers, we call them. They have to be registered with us. That's part of the quality assurance. And also the instructors have to go on an approved course and get an approved qualification. And then the instructors work for the Bikeability providers. So it's they who do all of the really hard work of training children, hard but fun. People do it because they enjoy it. It's very rewarding work to do. That's where it really all happens. Most of the training happens in schools. So those Bikeability providers work with the schools and then work with the children during school time.
How many instructors are there?
We've got about 5,000 on our books, but we think about 2,500 or so of those are are active, very active. We've got about 400 registered bikeability providers, and roughly half of those are active, delivering a lot of bikeability. There are a few small ones doing some, but not very much.
Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Paul Robeson. He is the CEO of Bikeability and the Bikeability Trust, a government-sanctioned organization in the UK that trains children to ride their bikes. It's a model I would love to see here in the States. To me, this is the answer to how we teach people to look out for cyclists and how to learn to ride correctly. And maybe you'll come here and explain how it works to the people in the U.S. in front of Congress. That would be so awesome. So, yeah, right. We'll see.
Well, I'd love to. We're very proud of it, actually. I mean, it's one of the few things I think that the UK has got to offer the world is the experience that we've got of setting up and running Bikeability. We've made some mistakes along the way. I'd love to be able to pass on those mistakes as well so that other people don't make the same mistakes when they're setting up. But it's a wonderful program. It's very good value for money.
Yes, yes, it certainly seems to be. It's not expensive.
No, not at all, not at all. And we've got evidence that shows that it's effective. So it's doing what we want, which is to get more children cycling and to get them to cycle more safely when they do cycle. So it's achieving both of those things.
Is this done in school? Or outside of school?
Yes, the vast majority is done in school. There are a few taught as holiday courses and so on, but the vast majority is in school time. But the schools cooperate. They love it. They think it's cycling is a life skill that children should be taught. And I think the schools and the head teachers are very well aware of all the benefits that cycling brings.
How long is the course? So if we take the first, I know it's in three parts, but how long does it take?
Okay, well, level one is 2 hours on the playground, minimum, 2 hours minimum. Level two is about between 6 and 8 hours on the road. They don't do it all in one go. They usually do it, say, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, a couple of hours each day, or every Monday for 4 weeks or whatever. There are different ways of doing it, but it's 6 to 8 hours of on-road training. And then level three is a minimum of 2 hours on the road.
So what if a child doesn't have a bike?
That can be an issue sometimes. A lot of our providers do provide bikes, spare bikes, for the children who don't have them. And sometimes the schools can help out with that. But we're very keen to improve on that and to make sure that no children get excluded because they don't have a bike at that stage in their life, because it is a life skill. We really want them to learn to cycle so that when they do get a bike at another stage in their life, they've got all the basics there.
Another question came up for me about the instructors. Are they volunteer or are they paid?
No, they're paid. So out of the £12 million a year that I mentioned that the Department for Transport puts in, that eventually my aim is that as much as possible of that ends up in the instructors' pockets, because they're doing a responsible job. They're doing it very well. We monitor the quality and so on. But they are paid for their work. That's a key difference to how it used to be in the UK. We did used to have a volunteer-led model called cycling proficiency, which started in the 1950s and went on until it was in full force right throughout the 1970s. And then sadly, it started to fall apart and become quite patchy. Some areas were doing it, some weren't, and some were doing it well, and some were just training them on the playground and so on. So it gradually fell apart, which is why we launched Bikeability to replace that. And made Bikeability more suitable for the modern age, recognizing that children, if they want to make a useful journey by bike, they are going to have to learn to share the road, because we're very much like the US. We don't have very much segregated cycling infrastructure. We'd love to, of course, but we don't.
Right.
And there's not much prospect of very much of that for the next few decades. And so we don't want the children to feel that they can't cycle because they can't go on the road. So we have to teach them to cycle on the road.
How did you become involved in this? This isn't what you've always done.
No, I was in the world of software and sort of entrepreneurship and so on for 20 or 30 years. But I've always been a mad keen cyclist since I was about three. When the opportunity came up to run Bikeability and to get more children to enjoy what I'd enjoyed doing all my life, I just couldn't resist it, really. And I think that's the... that's the motivation that a lot of our instructors have as well. They are enthusiastic about cycling and they want to pass on that enthusiasm in a structured way, you know, a structured and responsible way to the children. And importantly, that their parents have confidence in them cycling, because often the children's desire runs way ahead of their parents' willingness to let them. So that's quite an important thing for us, is to work more and better with the parents to firstly persuade them in the quality of the training that their children have had, because a lot of children come out of bikeability and they're really very good at cycling on the road. We've taught them well and they've absorbed it. And they've learned to judge risk for themselves, learning about priorities and communication with other road users. But their parents don't really realize any of this because they don't see it. They haven't seen how well their children have progressed. So they're still reluctant to let them cycle. So that's one of our biggest challenges in terms of getting the kids to carry on cycling afterwards.
Yeah, it would be nice if parents were involved a little more, perhaps.
Yeah, we do have, as well as the three core bikeability levels that I mentioned, 1, 2, and 3, we've got 10 other modules called Bikeability Plus collectively, and several of those are involved parents. So one of them is called Bikeability Parents, and that actually is about getting the parents to do the same training as the children have done, so they can experience it for themselves. And there's another one called Bikeability On Show, where the final session of their bikeability training, we invite the parents to come along so that they can see how good their children are, and various other ways of getting the parents involved. But it is a constant challenge to get time out of people's busy lives to pay attention to their children's cycling.
Right. Or to get them away from their tablets or whatever, their phones.
Yes, exactly.
So there's a monthly blog that you published and you do publish on the Bikeability site. And it talks about the work you're doing, this last one with the UCI. Tell me about that, because we're talking UCI. When I think of that, I think of racing. And when I think of what you're doing, I don't think of racing.
No, that's a very, very good observation. The UCI, the Union Cycliste Internationale, is the international governing body of the sport of cycling. But they have been quite forward thinking, especially in the last 5 years or so, in recognizing that in order to grow cycling as a sport, it needs a big funnel of potential talent who just ride bikes for everyday use. And the more people that cycle, the better it is for the sport. So it's not they're not sort of doing it for totally altruistic reasons, but they have a program called Cycling for All, and their motivation for that program really is to expand that potential talent. But it really is cycling for all, and they try. It's very much about utility cycling, daily commuting, or just leisure cycling, with absolutely no competitive aspect to it at all. They're quite serious about that, and because they have broad international reach, they make a fantastic partner for us to help spread the word about bikeability to all of their international sports federations, many of whom are quite enlightened in the same way and realise that cycling isn't just about the sport, and that it's in everyone's interest to promote normal everyday utility cycling as well. So the partnership does make sense, although I can see on the face of it, it does take a bit of explaining.
Has the Bikeability program expanded outside of the UK?
We've advised, for example, the New Zealand government. They were looking to introduce a cycling education program, and they did a trawl of what was going on in the world, and they ended up coming to us as the most mature government-funded cycle training program. So we helped them with designing their new program, which they've done very well. I actually would encourage people, if anybody wants to look at a good, well-designed program, probably to look at the New Zealand program just as closely as at Bikeability, because they've learned from some of the lessons that some of the mistakes that I told them about that we've made along the way. For example, not allowing your cycle training, your cycling education program, to be a standalone thing. It needs to be part of a bigger whole, a bigger cycling strategy that involves promotion, infrastructure, legal changes, and so on. So I'd say in New Zealand, they've taken that to heart, and they do have a good, broad cycling strategy, and they're being fairly successful as well. And various other countries as well, have approached us for advice. And that was part of my motivation behind working with the UCI, really, was to package up a lot of what we've learned and what we do and some of the well, it's not rocket science, but as that, you know, we've been doing it for 10 years and we've been constantly trying to improve it all along the way. So to distill that into a pack that's available for anybody who wants to try to get something similar to bikeability up and running wherever they live, working with either local or national government, ideally. And that would be my first starting point, really, is if you're going to have a program that's sustainable for the long run, then think about money, think about funding, and think about how you're going to make sure that that funding is protected or how are you going to guarantee that it keeps coming? Because nobody wants a stop-start program. It's quite easy to set up a cycle training program with volunteers, and it's great, often usually for a year or two. But then when the person who set it up, when they move on, things often fall apart. So the sustainability of the program, I think, is the thing that I would encourage people to think about hardest before they go set off down that route.
Yeah, it seems to me that here in the States, the way to do that is state by state.
Yeah.
It probably wouldn't work as a national program, but it might work as a state by state program. Well, this is just fascinating. If people who are listening are interested in finding out about what you are doing and how you're doing it, how would they find that out?
Probably there are two main websites. There's the Bikeability website itself, where they can find out about the program. That's bikeability.org.uk. Or they could come to the Bikeability Trust website, and just Googling Bikeability Trust will throw that up and it will show what we do behind the scenes. We don't really promote the Bikeability Trust website, but it will give them contact details and a way to contact us if they want to find out more. And probably if anybody's sort of seriously thinking about setting up something similar, then I would say wait for this UCI Bikeability Joint Pack to come out. The UCI are going to launch it at their World Congress at the end of September, and that will be publicly available and be a good starting point. I'm certainly not putting people off talking to us. If anybody wants to talk to us, we're always open and love talking about it. But the pack would be a good place for people to start, I think, once it's available.
Well, this has just been fascinating, and truly, we talk about education and education at the younger child level on the show all the time, and it's been just fascinating and a pleasure to talk with you about it, especially about a program that works so well. So thanks so much for talking with me. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, Diane, for the opportunity. I hope you can tell, I love talking about bikeability.
Yes, and, you do.
We're all very proud of it. So thanks for the opportunity.
Well, thanks again, Paul. I appreciate you talking with me.
Thanks very much, Diane.
Take care. All right.
Much appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Paul Robeson is the CEO of Bikeability. If you are interested in the program, you can log on to bikeability.org.uk. So let's take another real short break for a station ID, and then we'll head up to Green Bay, Wisconsin for a quick chat with Peter and Tracy Flukey. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Peter and Tracy Flukey have completed several really long tandem tours, including a 4,300-mile trip across the U.S. in 2014. So when they departed on a 7,000-mile trip this year, we decided we'd check in on them every month. Everything was under control in June, but then things started to get wonky. Hi, Peter and Tracy. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. This is our July call, but it's going to be a little different from what we expected. How are you two?
We're good. We are back in Green Bay, and like you said, a little different than we thought this call would be.
Right, exactly. We thought maybe you'd be a little bit closer to getting to New Orleans, which was going to be your endpoint, and not back home. Tell us what happened from the last time we spoke with you.
Well, so as we discussed earlier on, I mean, our big plan here was to do 7,000 miles, ending in New Orleans with an interim stop in Green Bay. But you make plans and then sometimes they work out and sometimes they don't. So when we talked to you last, things were going along pretty well, but we started having kind of a cascade, pun intended there, of issues related to, you know, lots of extreme climbing, also some mechanical issues and some residual effect too, I think, from Tracy's bicycle crash, both physically and mentally. So yeah, we stuck it out until Fallon, Nevada. So we ended up completing 1,456 miles and covering, I think, three national parks and having some just amazing experiences. But I think what happened is eventually we'd had enough adventure for one trip and decided to pull out and retool and try to get some balance back in our lives.
Yeah, I think that following you, I could see what was happening on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, sometimes you just have to stop what you're doing, reassess, and make the choice that's best for you. So before we talk about whether or not you're going to maybe continue and when and all of that, tell us a little bit about, between the last time we talked and this time, a couple of the things that you did see or you know experienced that would still be of interest. I mean, everything you were doing was really cool.
Yeah, it was a beautiful trip. I mean, the things we saw and the things we did were amazing. You know, the last time we talked to you, we were just outside Parkdale, Oregon, and we were in the Applore, in Mount Bachelor, I think, area. From that point on, we had like 90 miles of limited services, so it was a tough ride through there, lots of mountains and very limited services for us to, you know, get through. So we're almost to Detroit, Oregon, which is a very small town, and our drag brake on our bike goes out. And we have kind of a mountain pass to go down to get into Detroit. And when you think of a tandem, you know, we have about 400 pounds on that tandem, and it picks up speed very fast on a downhill. So Peter was, we're going down downhill, and he's trying to keep it under control without a drag brake and using the rim brakes. And the rims are getting so hot that we'd have to stop every now and then to be able to let them cool down because we were concerned about it blowing the tire. So that was one of our first more major type incidents that we had with the bike, that we almost ended up walking down the mountain pass because we couldn't keep the bike under control or not worry about blowing the tire. We did get into Detroit, and then from there, we were lucky enough to get a ride from a woman that was going to Bend, Oregon, because that was our closest bike shop, and she towed us and our bike into Bend, Oregon. So we got there and stayed three days, at the warm shower stay, because I had a medical thing I had to deal with. So yeah, so it seemed like after we talked to you, a lot of weird things started happening, and a lot of the riding got really tough, too.
So how did you... once you made the decision to abandon the trip for now, what did you do exactly? Where did you stop? And then I think I read something about putting the bike on a train, maybe? What were you doing? Oh, no, you were going to do that.
Yeah, so before we get too far with this, I mean, like I said at the beginning, we did actually hit three national parks. You know, Crater Lake National Park is probably one of the most astounding places that you can go in this country visually. And when you've climbed uphill on a fully loaded tandem to get there, I don't know if you can make the appreciation of those vistas and that place any better, but I think you can. And that was the same thing with Lassen Volcanic National Park and the Olympic National Park. So I mean, we're talking about some of the bad stuff, but it wasn't all bad, or we certainly wouldn't have kept going. To answer your question, though, we were in Fallon, New Mexico, and we were just about to start riding the loneliest road in America, which is Highway 50, and it's through the high desert in Nevada. And what we were looking at on the good side was reasonably good weather. It was, you know, mid-80s for temperatures, so that was pretty manageable. And we were looking at way less traffic on the road, which had been a huge factor earlier on. But we had a loose hub on the rear of the bike, and we also had a couple of stretches with 80 miles with zero services coming up. So we would have had to carry all the water, everything with us. And we had a couple of people suggest that we actually carry a sign with us that said water on it, because if something went to heck, apparently people are pretty good about pulling over and giving you water.
Wow. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Peter and Tracy Flukey. We've talked to them several times before on this trip. They've been planning this trip. How long did you plan this trip?
Six months. I mean, it was always sort of the back of our head, but yeah, I mean, 6 months of training, certainly. And, you know, the idea had been there longer than that.
All right. And this was going to be a 7,000 mile trip. This is not their first rodeo with the tandem. And so how many national parks were originally planned in your trip? Do you know?
I don't know what the total number was, but we certainly picked off the three that were in the first 1,400 miles. So, yeah, I mean, I think adventure cycling, you know, tries to hit those kinds of features wherever they can.
So you guys are back home. Everything is safe. How is the bike? I know that you've been having some mechanical issues with the bike.
Yeah, well, it's kind of funny. We have had a couple of issues. Both the spokes on the rear and the front, or the rear and the front wheel loosened up on us during the trip. I was able to manage them in route, but then we had to get them, you know, retensioned at the bike shop. They are new wheels. I'd never had them on the bike fully loaded, so might have been my bad. You know, had a couple of flats, managed to wear out the sidewall on a rear tire. I was planning on repairing it or replacing it the next day, and Tracy said, "What's that rubbing sound?" And that's the tube poking out of the side of your tire. But if you get it changed and replaced before it goes bang, yay for us.
Yeah, right.
I actually had a shifter crack, my right front shifter, and I really think that when the drag brake went out, I was literally death gripping the thing. The shifter still worked. I didn't know there were extra parts in a 10-speed Shimano shifter, but apparently there are. So, you know, it was little things like that. And then the last thing was that the rear hub had loosened up. It was probably adjustable and manageable, but I didn't have the tools, and we were in Fallon, New Mexico. So, you know, in all fairness, that's a 2000 Santana Arriva with probably 50, 60,000 miles of loaded touring on it. So, you know, none of those things in and of themselves were deal breakers, but it's kind of that, like that old car when you close the door for the last time and the door handle goes flying
right
across the car. Might be time for a new tandem, and we'll keep that one as a spare.
Right, right. So going forward, what are you guys going to do for the next, say, 6 months, year? And are you going to try to reestablish this trip?
You know, we're still in the thinking process on that. One of the things that I need to figure out is my knee. One of the things we really noticed on the trip is my power really deteriorated as we got further and further into the trip, because my knee is just not as strong as it once was. So just climbing the mountain passes was tough enough. And then when my strength started to fade, then Peter had to pick up more. So it added to his strain as well. So you got to get that figured out and maybe, you know, try some shorter trips for a bit and see how that all works out. And then, you know, go from there. We'll think about it. You know, we'd still like to continue on with the trip and try to finish it or pick it off in pieces and see what we can do on that. So it definitely is not off the table, but it's just a matter of us really, you know, getting our feet settled here again and thinking about it and getting ready for it both physically and mentally again.
Well, I wish you guys a lot of luck. I know it's not like you have nothing to do. I know you have a full plate schedule of stuff that you can pick back up on. People can still follow what you did do at your blog, webike.org, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's some great pictures up there. And, you know, it's funny because when we look at it, it's, you know, only 1,400 miles of a, you know, potential 7,000-mile trip. But we have to keep reminding ourselves, many people don't have the resources, the ability, the skill level, the desire, you know, to even do a 1,400, let alone in the mountains with some of the things that we experience. When you pull this trip out and have it stand on its own, it was still, you know, just one of those experiences of a lifetime.
Right. Right. Well, I'm really glad we got to talk. I know we'll talk again in the not too distant future to figure out what's going on next. And you have other projects, as I said. So we've been talking with Tracy and Peter Flukey. They abandoned their trip after 1,456 miles, which is still a ton of miles, lots of climbing, three national parks. You can find out more at webike.org. Good luck to both of you. Thanks so much for talking with me again.
Thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Peter and Tracy Flukey joined me from their home in Green Bay, Wisconsin. If you're interested in their 4,300-mile trip from 2014 or their most recent 1,456-mile trip on the West Coast, you can log on to webike.org. All right, it's one more quick break, and then it's off to Pennsylvania to speak with Leah Flickinger about, well, a whole lot of things. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. On May 15th, Leah Flickinger's article titled "The Most Badass Woman in Bike Racing is Back" about Ina Oiko-Teutenberg. It's a fascinating piece, and there's a lot more to Leah as the director of content creation at the Hearst Enthusiast Group, which includes bicycling, Runner's World, and Popular Mechanics. Hi, Leah. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, it's my pleasure. We never had a chance to talk while you were the editor-in-chief of Bicycling, but I always knew you were back there directing everything. And I thought maybe now would be a good time to catch up. I read one of your articles recently that was just mind-blowing. It was so good. So can you tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, where you went to school, and how you became interested in journalism as a career?
Sure. I mean, I always, when people ask me that question, I always laugh. I'm like, well, get ready. It's a little bit of a circuitous journey. But yeah, I grew up in a suburb of New York City. And I went to college in Boston at Tufts University, but really did not know that I was interested in journalism or publishing for a long time. I was kind of a little bit wayward after college, and that I just did not know what I wanted to do. Moved to New York City. I had been an art history major, so I got a job in the art world at an auction house. Wasn't super stoked about that after a couple of years, and then knew I didn't want to live in New York City long term and was looking for something I could do anywhere. And so that led me to get a degree, a master's degree in education, which I kind of realized by the end of the program that working in a classroom with kids was probably not the best fit for me. kids are cute and everything, but yeah, I mean, what I was really, I was just more into the research and the writing and, sort of the more academic side of it. But I had a scholarship to, my graduate program. And part of that scholarship was editing the campus newsletter, or the graduate school newsletter, I don't even remember now. And I really loved that. I don't even know why, but I just was like, ooh, this is cool and fun, putting words together and making this thing that people read. But then I ignored that and got a job in sort of like educational policy and working at a nonprofit in fundraising, writing grant proposals. And then again, I was editing a newsletter there and I was like, oh, this newsletter thing is really fun. A few more years went by and I ended up moving out to the area in Pennsylvania where Rodale Press was located, which publishes Bicycling and a number of other publications. I got a job there. They had a nonprofit organization that set up sustainable agriculture programs around the world. And I did fundraising again and newsletter editing there and still loved it, but like still was kind of clueless about, oh, you should go into publishing. And then a job opened up in the book division at Rodale for a fact checker. And by this time I had been working for like 10 years after college, but I was you know, I was like, you know, I really like the newsletter thing. I don't really like the fundraising thing. Let me try this fact checking thing. And like, that was it. I was hooked. And I just kind of grew from there. So like, I started as a fact checker in the book division and then eventually became a book editor. And then Rodale began, they launched a magazine called Women's Health. And I was on the launch team for that magazine as a senior editor. From Women's Health, I moved over to bicycling, and around, I think it was 2010, as an executive editor. The editor-in-chief at the time was Peter Flax. And then, yeah, that's how it all happened. But it was sort of accidental.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I never in a million years would have said, oh, I'm going to have a career as a bicycle retailer when I was growing up. It was one of those, what are you thinking? Really, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Leah Blumenthal Flickinger. She was the editor-in-chief of Bicycling. She's with the Hearst Enthusiast Group. We'll talk about that later. But somehow or another, you also do some really interesting writing on your own. Whether you're editing somebody else's stuff is not what I want to really talk about. I wanted to know about the story. Now, I didn't know, and I don't know why I didn't know, Ina Oko Tutenberg. I assume that is the correct pronunciation. What a great story you wrote about her not too long ago. So you are still doing your own writing, clearly.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, I was an editor for so long, and I would do some writing. You know, I would do product reviews or maybe some personal essays now and then. But there really was never time for me to explore writing that much when I was an editor. But I left Bicycling in 2018 after Hearst bought Rodale. And I spent last year freelancing. And one of the first stories that I pitched was a profile of Ina Oko Tutenberg, who it had just been announced last summer that she was named as the director sportif for the new Trek Segafredo women's team. And she just had a really interesting story that I was aware of. You know, she was one of the winningest bike racers, female bike racers of all time. And then she crashed in her what she didn't know was going to be her last race, but in a sort of smallish race in the Netherlands, and ended up having to retire after that because of her, she sustained a pretty serious head injury and was dealing with the after effects of concussion. And I had always thought it was sort of sad that she went out like that. You know, she didn't really get to go out on her own terms in a way. And I felt like this news that she was being, you know, that she was brought in to help run this team and sort of give back her wisdom to this next generation was a really powerful story. So, yeah.
Yeah. And so what I found really interesting about the story was you took it from sort of start to finish. And it's I'm thinking about a couple of other crashes that happened this year.
Yeah.
One of them, I think Kelly, her name was, you know, that she went through almost the same thing that Ina, say it again for me, her name.
We can just call her Ina.
Ina went through. Somehow Ina came out on the other side where Kelly did not. And so these concussion cases, I don't know, they're really scary, really scary.
Yeah. I mean, the Kelly Catlin story is a little, you know, it's complicated. The family believes that she sustained a head injury in a crash prior to the suicide. And that's why, you know, she found, I guess, living intolerable ultimately. And it's just tragic, especially when, you know, what sometimes happens is these head injuries are either ignored or people aren't even really aware that it was as serious as it was.
Right.
Yeah.
So do you follow women's cycling in general?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I would say that there's like with anything, there's sometimes that I'm more into it than other times.
Right.
I do enjoy women's racing. I tend to follow it more than men's racing. I'm not sure why. It's a little bit less available to watch, but when it is available, I do like to watch it.
Well, that brings me to my next question, and that is, even though you're not really an outsider, you know, having been involved in bicycling for so long, but right. would you say that women's cycling is beginning to sort of turn the corner and sort of like women's soccer and maybe heading yeah. on an upward trajectory?
I'd like to think so. You know, there's been this year, you know, Trek has really stepped up with its support with its Trek Segafredo team, where the women's team is being operated sort of on the same model as the men's team with, you know, similar resources, et cetera. And then they also provided, they supported, I think it was daily hour-long recaps of the Giro Rosa, which just wrapped up last week.
Right.
You know, things like that. They also, you know, Trek again, with the Trek, the cyclocross race in Waterloo in their backyard, where they featured the women's race as the marquee event, as you know, instead of the men's race, and offered equal prize money. I mean, those are all really great steps. The Colorado Classic coming up in August has been sort of reinvented as a women's only stage race, and there are, you do see steps like that that feel really positive. And then sometimes, though, it still seems like there's like two steps back. So I think it's like, you know, I think it's improving in fits and starts. There's still a long way to go. But, you know, it's a whole different ball game than it was, you know, even 10 years ago when I started at bicycling, or 12 years ago now. You know, the depth of the talent in the women's peloton. I mean, if we're talking about the, you know, professional, the highest level of professional racing, the depth of talent is just so much deeper than it used to be. You know, there are more teams that are super competitive. It's no longer, you know, well, it's going to be Mariana Voss who's going right. to win. There are a lot of contenders, and it's much more exciting because of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with, I'm just going to call her Leah Flickinger. Isn't that how you go, really? Do you use your,
yes.
do you use, okay.
Yes.
Okay. Good. Well, that's who she is. And she was the editor-in-chief of Bicycling, and she's working still in the publishing world. I wanted to ask you something more on the industry side, since I have sure. a particular interest in that. You probably yeah. did have a lot of contact with the industry side of cycling while you were at Bicycling. Did you see any directions or trends before you left that kind of concerned you as to the health of the bicycle industry, since I see it from a retailer perspective and you kind mm-hmm. of had a kind of neutral place to look at it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I never feel like the best person to talk about this, but I think informally I can talk about it a little bit. I feel like the retail industry, you know, is suffering as the entire retail industry is, right? As more people, you know, turn to online shopping, you know, I think many retailers have been sort of caught out, maybe not quite ready for that transition. It's much more complicated than that and more nuanced than I can probably get into. But, you know, I think that that's a big challenge for the industry. So now I'm at Hearst, which owns Bicycling, and I'm working as director of content creation for Bicycling Runners World and Popular Mechanics. But at Bicycling, we recently published a story about, you know, how people feel they're treated in bike shops.
Yes, and you did.
Yes, we did. And I know it was, you know, certainly not the news that bike shops, that retailers wanted to hear, but our survey, you know, found that 60% of people, you know, reported being treated poorly in a bike shop. I mean, I think the story too did look at many of the good shops that are out there. And, you know, it's unfortunate, I think, because it's harder to remember sometimes the good interactions and it's the bad ones that stick out. But I've been in bike shops where I've been yelled at as soon as I walk in the door, you know, and it's something that as a customer service, with the customer facing part of the retailer industry needs to kind of to really take a hard look at, I think.
Yeah, it seems to me that bike shops, for some reason, are prone to hiring and not training people to be customer service oriented. You know, they'll you know, a kid comes in and goes, "Oh, I really like bikes and I work on my own bike. Will you hire me?" and without any formal training on the other side of that service wall, you know, to the person who comes in, which is, you know, that is your first line of defense when somebody comes in the door. You better be greeting them and doing that stuff. So, yeah, I it's interesting that that was the survey. Ugh, it's too bad that was the survey. So what else are you working on with Hearst? Popular Mechanics, what an interesting magazine. I mean, my husband would be all over that. Being
I know, my husband is pretty excited. yeah, I mean, it's been interesting. You know, today I was having kind of a crazy day where I'm working on a story for Bicycling and one for Runner's World and one for Popular Mechanics. And it's just like the breadth, the difference between subject areas is so great. It's a little mind-numbing, but it's also really cool. Like, we just closed an issue of Popular Mechanics, and it's the first one that I worked on, and I edited a story about horseshoe crab blood, which is not something that I ever thought I would even say out loud. And it was pretty fascinating.
I know about this. I can't remember. Yeah. They string these horseshoe crabs up and ooh, yes. I remember hearing something. Maybe it was a podcast.
Yeah. It's pretty upsetting. But the blood is a detector of endotoxins, and it's used by the pharmaceutical industry. But the crabs are endangered.
Wow.
But it was, I mean, it's a fascinating story, and I do love the sciencey, nerdy aspect of Popular Mechanics. And they just cover such a wide range of subject areas that it's never going to be boring. That's for sure.
That's cool. I mean, to have those three topics, bicycling, running, and mechanics. It sounds,
I know.
It's sort of
I
like.
I know, but the whole, the, you know, the common denominator is, you know, enthusiasts, right? So people really are, you know, deep into the thing that they're interested in.
Right.
So
obviously you don't work all the time. Do you ride?
Right. I do ride. I love my road bike. I also love mountain biking, but I consider myself like a pretty casual rider. I like to go fast, but I'm not a fast rider.
Right. Welcome to my world.
Yeah. You know, it's weird. You know, it's always been weird being in the industry and not really considering myself a fast rider, but I'm like kind of at peace with that now. And I'm a big fan of e-bikes. I don't have one, but I would love one. It's just a matter of like which one.
Yeah, me too. So many different types. I would love one.
Yeah, I brought home one year at Christmas. I brought home the Risa Mueller. I forget what the name of it is, but it has the big cargo box in the front. Hmm. And I rode around the neighborhood with my little niece and nephew on Christmas Eve, and they thought they were like they thought we were basically like Santa Claus and the reindeer, and I was like the coolest aunt ever.
Points. You got points for that. That does sound fun. That does sound like fun. What kind of road bike do you have?
I have a Specialized Amira.
Nice.
Yeah. Been riding that for a while. I like it. Yeah. I like to find as many lightly trafficked roads as I can. We have a lot of good gravel in this part of Pennsylvania, so I'm always in search of gravel roads.
You're still up near Emmaus?
Yeah. I live about a half hour away from Emmaus.
So are there trails? I mean, we have the towpath here. We've got some trails. That's how we ride. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a really great towpath right near my house. The D&L Canal Trail.
Nice.
It goes up and down the Delaware River, and it's awesome.
Yeah. Well, are you working on any special projects you can share? Like something coming up in bicycling?
I don't know if I can share anything in particular, but. I'm still sort of at that new phase where I'm just kind of like almost a little overwhelmed with everything. There's a lot of fun stuff going on.
That's good. So let me ask you a question. Who's your gear editor now? Gloria is not doing that, is she?
Well, we still have Matt Phillips.
Okay. I've usually spoken with, so once a year for holiday, I used to bring Gloria on and we'd talk about holiday gifts. So I guess I'm going to have to talk to him.
Yeah.
And that would be fine with me.
Yeah, we have a whole test team, so
yes.
It would either be him or someone else.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. Well, when I talk to fun guests, I ask them three questions, and I'm going to ask you three questions. What's your favorite food?
I really like like Szechuan eggplant with white rice.
Well, very specific. I like that. You know, like when you talk to frame builders, 90% of, well, I would say 50% say pizza and the other 50% say tacos. So that was good. I like that. A little different. What kind of music do you listen to?
I listen to all kinds of stuff, really depending on my mood. I love like jazz standards. I love, you know, reggaeton. I love Broadway show tunes. I mean, it just depends on my mood.
And how about pets? Do you have any pets?
Yes, we have a 13-year-old border collie.
My husband will be so jealous. He grew up with a border collie. We do not have one at this time. I said, how much energy do you have? But okay.
Yeah.
That's it? Just one border collie
puppy? Well, no, and we have one cat.
Oh, okay. Well, this has been fun. I'm really glad we got to talk again.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, we've been talking with Leah Flickinger. She is, so what is your title now at Hearst Enthusiast Group?
It's Director of Content Creation.
She is Director of Content Creation, and her properties are Bicycling, Runner's World of Still, is that what it's called? Mm-hmm. And
yes.
Popular Mechanics, which there are plenty of my listeners who will love that. Thank you so much for talking with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Diane.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Phew, that was a big show this week. My thanks to all my guests, Jeff Wolf from More for Helmets, Paul Robeson from Bikeability, Peter and Tracy Flukey, and Leah Flickinger. Believe it or not, next week's show will be the last one for July already, and I'm working on some great stories. Thanks so much for listening. Please remember to rate the show on your favorite podcast app. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe out there, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.